Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call and talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We convene the Science Forum today. We've gathered our scientists, and they're ready to answer your questions and comments. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website. You go to WAMC.org/VoxPop. Scroll down a bit, you'll see a spot for your comments. You can also comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Hang in there, Ed. The show's almost over. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop as well. Or, you know, you could just call us. It's 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Let's meet the scientist. Dr. Helen Giardella is professor of biological sciences at the State University of New York at Albany. First, Helen, your headphone level okay?
Yeah.
You can hear me?
Yes, I can.
Not too loudly?
Not too loudly.
Okay. You're set. Dr. Ed Stander is a professor of geology and astronomy at the State University of New York at Cobleskill. Hi, Ed. Welcome aboard.
Well, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's a smaller panel than usual, so that means extra pressure on both of you. Are you up to the challenge?
Just means less mistakes.
Oh boy, it's 10 after and 2 minutes into the show, and already some shots have been fired. All right, Ed, let's talk a little bit about the meteor over Russia. The asteroid was not really much to, it was, yes, astronomically close at 17,000 miles, and yes, inside the geosynchronous orbits of those satellites. But, you know, for you and me, that's, those of us watching, nothing to see.
There are some great pictures of it taken with telescopes.
Okay, all right, I'll buy that. But the meteor in Russia,
that was more exciting.
That was very exciting. And, you know, everyone says not connected. In any way. It's just a coincidence. That's a hell of a coincidence.
I think so. You know, I've been looking to try and find out whether they were both traveling the same direction.
Yeah.
And I found nothing so far. So I don't know. For myself, of course, I couldn't tell anyway because I wasn't there.
Right.
But it is one heck of a coincidence, that's for sure.
You know, it seems to me, I guess there were also some fairly big bolides in Cuba and California after the asteroid passed. Is it possible that this thing, which they've tracked for a year, this asteroid, just had a field of little debris from collisions that we weren't tracking that maybe was a little ahead and a little behind?
Well, there's lots of possibilities. One possibility is that as it goes by something, it can perturb it enough to go into our orbit and come in.
So there would be some connection then?
Oh, there could be. Okay. There could very well be, and it could be coming in any direction at that point.
1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Let's go to the phones. It's Jerry in Schenectady. Jerry, you're on.
Yes. Hi. I was just listening in, that's exactly what my question was going to be on, is exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Now, and I tried to think of something else, and I couldn't. So if you want to expound more upon it, I'd be willing to listen, but I have nothing else.
You don't want to follow up in any way?
I was just going to say it. Well, no.
All right. Well, you know what, Jerry? If you come up with another question during this program, I'm going to give you let you go to the head of the line because I stole your thunder. All right.
That's all right. It was worth it.
All right, buddy. Thanks a lot for the call.
You.
Yep. 1-800-348-2551. Well, there I go, ruining the fun for everyone.
Let me interject a question.
Okay.
Meteor showers, I'm assuming, are something that broke up, and whose fragments are traveling together. And
no, actually, no.
They're not. Okay.
No, meteor showers are usually caused by comet tails.
Okay.
If you have, if a comet passes the orbit of the Earth, it forms a cloud of dust behind it. And as we go through that, we get meteors.
Okay.
And usually they come from one location.
Mm-hmm.
And that one location is the direction we're moving. Just like if you're in a car and raindrops are coming at you, they seem to be coming from a point or a star.
And that would be a constellation, and that's how they get their name?
That's right.
So Leonids.
That's right. So the Leonids, we're moving towards Leo at that time in our orbit, and we go through the cloud of dust.
Okay.
So that's why every year they come the same time.
And just to put it in perspective, most of the ones that we see in the Perseids or the Leonids, they're tiny little specks, right?
They're on the order of microns. Yeah,
okay.
Half inch is large.
Okay, but the one that everyone caught on their dashboard cam, which apparently everybody has in Russia, was a big one.
Yeah, it was about the size of a bus.
Okay.
Oh,
it wasn't big enough to see as it was coming in, but when it came in, it was easy to see.
And, you know, some of the news reports I saw said it was 10,000 tons. Can that be true?
7,000 tons, yeah.
Wow. All right, let's go back to the phones. And Bill in Little Falls. Bill, you're on.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is regarding the meteor over Russia. When it exploded, did it release any dangerous radiation? And I'll listen for the answer on the radio.
All right, Bill, thanks a lot. Radiation,
First of all, I haven't heard what kind of meteorite it is.
So in other words, it could be iron or...
It could either be iron. Most meteorites that come in are called chondrites. And effectively what they are the garbage that's left over from the formation of the planets.
Okay.
A lot of them come from the asteroid belt. And they get perturbed by Mars or by Jupiter and they go shooting into the inner area and we get a hold of them. Chondrites, things like that, there should be no danger of dust whatsoever. The only time I've ever heard of something coming near our atmosphere that actually was giving off a poison gas, if you want, was the question of Halley's Comet.
Really?
Back in the 1900s, they did some measurements with spectroscopes before it came in and discovered it was giving off arsenic.
Ah.
And people were actually afraid that they were going to die as the Earth went through the orbit of the comet. But nobody did, apparently, so we were okay.
Okay.
I think that's why we're here, actually.
All right. And from what I have seen on news reports, they're all sketchy for some reason. You know, the footage was very vivid, and the post-event news has been a bit sketchy, but apparently it was the most common type. They found little tiny fragments, but not the big fragment.
Well, there may not be a big fragment. Chondrites tend to blow up. It came in at about, 33,000 miles per hour?
Yeah.
Which is escape velocity for the Earth is 26,000 miles per hour. So it was coming really, really fast. And it effectively, when it hit the atmosphere, it blew up. And that's what the shock wave was that blew all the windows. So there may not be a big piece.
Very interesting. Helen Giardella is our guest. Also, Ed Stander. It's the Science Forum. The phone number to call, 1-800-348-2551. Helen is a professor of biological sciences. So we needn't talk solely about the meteor. I mean, we could talk about other things if something is on your mind. Ed is a professor of geology and astronomy, and, you know, I'm in radio, so I can barely tie my shoes. Let's go to the phones. It's John and Wyndham. John, you're on.
Yes. Horizontal drilling for gas and oil. My question is, how do you drill down vertically a mile and make a 90-degree turn and drill out horizontally? I don't know if either of your people are... involved in that sort of thing. Certainly your doc from SUNY Albany would possibly have some knowledge. I don't know about the biologists.
All right, well, let's check with my
peeps. All right,
what do you think?
That's actually a very good question. Usually, I can't give you a definitive answer for it. I can tell you that when you're drilling, usually the drill stem will not go straight down. If it hits a rock layer that it doesn't like, it'll start to turn by itself. How they actually make it start to turn at a particular point, that I don't know, but if you'd like, I can take that for homework and I'll give you an answer next
time. Great idea. All right, John?
Well, that would be much appreciated. And
I'd be glad to.
Hopefully, I'll be listening the next time you're on.
That's a good plan. Thank you, John. The phone number to call here is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Bruce in Woodstock. Bruce, you're on the Science Forum.
Great. You guys are terrific. Here's the thing. Wouldn't you not say that the way that that meteor came over Russia and then exploded and so forth was pretty much the same way the one in 1913, the one out there on
1908.
The...
1908.
I believe
so. Yeah, yeah.
Let's not quibble about 5 years.
Right.
I'm just kidding.
I understand. All right.
So it did pretty much the same thing that people had speculated that one did, would you say?
Well, meteorites, we get 11,000 tons of meteorites in a year, and a lot of it's small. So I couldn't say...
Remember 1908, right?
You're right.
Yeah, sure.
I wasn't here.
What was the name of the place?
Tunguska.
Yeah, okay. So the way it was effective, you know, the exploding of it and the smashing of all the trees from that central part...
I understand
Siberia,
what you're talking about. You're talking about the Siberian,
the effect that has, and people would say, like, whoa, it was a bomb, it was this, that, and this. Doesn't this pretty much...
Except for one thing.
Yeah.
Except for one thing. There was no meteorite ever found there.
Nope. Well, tiny bits.
So it could have been a little bit higher. It could have blown up into more pieces.
No, because it all came from a particular location. It all came from a central location and then spread outward in all directions. And what people think it was a comet, not a meteorite. Mm.
Okay.
And something, effectively, yes, the same thing. Exactly the same. Russia gets it all the time.
We'll call it heavenly. Anyhow, yeah. I did hear that both the meteor that went down over there and the asteroid were coming from different directions.
Yes, I did hear that. In other words,
yes.
Yeah.
Except that it doesn't really matter, as I said, because if a large asteroid goes through near the Earth's atmosphere, it can stir up stuff, because as it gets closer to items out there, then they'll be picked up by the gravity of those items and they'll be slingshotted into the Earth's atmosphere.
How much gravity can a bus size 7-ton asteroid.
Well, he's talking about the big asteroid.
Yeah, the big asteroid was a lot bigger than a bus size, and it could have perturbed the gravitational field around things out there to make them come into the atmosphere.
What was that one? That was about 50 yards? 100 yards?
Yeah, I think it was something like 500, if I remember right.
Hey, Bruce, we got to take a break here, my friend, but thank you. We got to take a break. Zach, let's do that, and then back with the Science Forum. 1-800-348-2551 is the number.
Support for WAMC comes from Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication, rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. AshfieldStone.com. The Birch School, Orange County, a new independent day school and center for homeschool classes, working to provide a child-centered, nature-based learning community for ages 4 to 17. TheBirchSchool.org. Hudson Valley Bounty, an initiative of the Hudson Valley Agribusiness Development Corporation, promoting Hudson Valley farms, wineries, restaurants, and more, HudsonValleyBounty.com. And Wiawaka Lake George, New York, an enrichment and revitalization historic lakefront retreat created by and for women since 1903, WIAWAKA.org for events.
The Science Forum on WAMC's Vox Pop. Dr. Helen Giardella is here, and Dr. Ed Stander, and your calls at 1-800-348-2551. Daryl in Johnstown is on. Hi, Daryl.
Good afternoon, folks. My question is about styrofoam. I'm not too far off. But we know it's a major problem in landfills. And when I was a kid, I remember having a can of gasoline and dropping some styrofoam in it. It bubbled.
Yep.
It no longer became visible to the naked eye. It changed form. And what I'm wondering about is, has there been studies on something like that? Is it releasing something dangerous into the atmosphere? Can it be used to eliminate styrofoam? The substance that's left, let's say, in that can that be used? I mean, the questions can go on and on and on about my comment, but it really boils down to, has studies been done on it?
Okay. Well, Helen, what do you think?
I'm afraid I have to bow out on this one because, again, it's not within my field.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, I have taken a garbage bag, a garbage can full of styrofoam peanuts, and dissolved them to nothing in acetone.
Okay,
it's very, very easy to do, and it's an easy way to get rid of them.
What happens? What is released? What happens?
Well, effectively, they're just popped air. With a very, very little bit of material. And when you put them in acetone, you're effectively releasing the air.
Mm.
There's nothing in there that's really dangerous. You're not releasing Freon or anything like that.
Okay.
So it's a pretty straightforward operation. They collapse to nothing in any case.
Well,
so
what's the basic plastic?
Room.
You know, I come from Fulton County, and we have a major recycling plant here. As a matter of fact, people bring things from other counties just to recycle them. I'm wondering if they have any scientists that I could discuss that with, you know?
Well,
as long as it doesn't release anything dangerous. You know?
Oh, it doesn't release anything dangerous. It's a pretty straightforward operation.
Well, the substances that you and I just spoke of, the gasoline and the acetone, I'm wondering if those substances now, with the properties of what's left from that styrofoam, could be used for something like
a high energy fuel or something like that.
Well, it could be, but the best thing to do with styrofoam is use it as insulation. Mm-hmm. You could fill a nice house up with styrofoam peanuts, and it would do a fantastic job of insulating the house.
All right.
Yeah,
that's what I do with
it. It's also very flammable, though.
Well, there is that problem.
Well, that,
there's a danger right there,
I think. That's a good point. Daryl, thanks a lot for the call. We go over to Russ in Woodsboro. Russ, you're on.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
I have a question about black holes. I've watched on various television shows, and I understand that the mass of the black hole is so great that light doesn't even have the escape velocity to leave the black hole, and yet from what I've seen, it says that when a black hole is, quote-unquote, eating, that it releases energy at the two poles. I'm confused by this because if light can't escape and nothing can escape the black holes, how can it release energy?
That's a great question. It has to do with the event horizon. It has to do with the fact that there is a position with respect to the black hole where nothing can get out. But if it's if it's further out from that point, then it can escape. For example, the way we find black holes very often is because they have a very, very large area around them in which the stars that are being eaten up are effectively falling apart. And so there's this plasma layer that goes all around it on all sides. And we can see that. Similarly, that stuff gets sent out by effectively an extremely strong magnetic force that's within the black hole in these two directions in X-rays. So that's not material that's actually fallen into the black hole. That's material that's coming near the black hole and has been sped up, but not so much that that its escape velocity is less than that of the black hole's gravity.
Wonderful. That explains it perfectly.
Okay.
I'm going to interject here, if I may.
Please do, Helen.
Many, many years ago, a very similar question came up, but this was from one of the school kids.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a fifth grader who said, if black holes have so much gravity that anything that gets in can't get out, and light can't get out, and matter can't get out, and nothing can get out, how does the gravity get out to suck everything in? And nobody on the panel was quite up to handling this.
Well, no one truly knows what gravity is, right?
We have a pretty good idea. It's a warping of space-time due to mass. So in the case of a black hole, the warping is so great that effectively it goes into another dimension that we don't understand.
But you have answered
the
question.
You
just answered it for me, at least.
I would interject something else, though, which I've thought of, which nobody else has ever thought of in the entire world. And that's the fact that there are places out in the universe where there are thousands of stars that all have the same age and the same structure and the same composition.
Okay.
And it's very difficult to make a star unless you make it from another star. And if you have a place, and these are called clusters, if you have a large cluster like the Beehive Cluster that contains 100,000 stars that all have the same age and composition, how do you get that much material in one place? And the chances are, what happens is at some point or another, and we don't know how, black holes
spit them out.
Effectively, they disappear, and they produce a huge amount of material in a small place that all is the same.
Wow. Well,
wow.
That's very interesting.
So it's possible.
We're going into places I didn't think we would go on this Vox Pop.
Where no person has gone before.
Thank you, Admiral Kirk. Let's go to Matt in Troy. Matt, you're on.
Hello. I have a question about hydrofracking. I understand that there's a risk of earthquakes due to, pushing water down or other fluids down at such high pressures that sort of the bedrock starts to shake. What is the danger of these earthquakes? Are there going to be 10 on the Richter scale? How much damage can they produce?
Okay, the evidence for that sort of thing happening comes from Denver, Colorado in the 1980s or 70s. I can't remember exactly when. They were base there was producing mustard gas, and they were taking the liquid and putting it into the ground, and it was producing earthquakes.
Mm.
The reason it was producing earthquakes is because the liquid was actually going into a fault that was already there that nobody knew about, and it was lubricating it and releasing the pressure. Okay, so
it was a pre-existing fault was compromised.
That's right. It was a pre-existing fault, and it actually was a newspaper reporter down there who got the information because the government wasn't saying anything about it.
Right.
But the earthquakes themselves were quite small, and they would not be large unless the earthquake zone had a lot of pressure built up on it.
So it would inevitably happen anyway, then.
Well, it could happen.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yes, it could happen, but if it does happen, it'll, generally speaking, be very small because we don't have those kind of faults around here, not like we have on the West Coast.
Interesting. Hey, Matt, thanks a lot for the call. Although, was there not some speculation a year or two ago about some swarms of earthquakes
in
Missouri or somewhere down in the south?
Oh, well, there's a when an ocean opens up, it often opens up on what's called a triple juncture. In other words, three directions, 120 degrees apart.
Okay.
Two of those directions become an ocean. The third direction becomes sort of a fault line, a fault zone.
Mm-hmm. Like the Great Rift Valley.
Like the Great Rift Valley is a good example.
Right.
And those fault zones are often places where rivers form because the rock is broken up there. So the Mississippi, the Amazon, the Connecticut River, all these things are built on these areas of loose rock.
Mm-hmm.
So if something happens, if you get a little bit of pressure release in there, the rock's already broken. So it's a good place for a fault.
Very interesting. Let's go to Jerry in Ulster. Jerry, you're on.
This is a simple question. I've always been a little confused about the nature of the explosion that takes place when, say, a comet like Shoemaker-Levy impacts the outer atmosphere of something as huge as Jupiter at many, many thousands of miles an hour. Is that a molecular or an atomic release of energy?
Well, it's an what kind of energy is released? Is that what your question is?
Well, I mean, you know, if it's molecular, I mean, it's like a regular explosion of a TNT or something. But if it was if it's atomic, then there would be a release of radiation.
Oh, well, it's certainly not atomic. Uranium is extremely rare in the universe.
No, but E equals MC squared applies to anything, doesn't it?
It applies to TNT as well. Anytime you take matter and destroy it, you wind up producing energy, but it's not necessarily radioactive.
But how could you? I remember that impact, those impacts.
Oh, yeah.
I can't, you know, and there were great flashes of snow-white light that some I'd heard were almost as big as a small continent. I mean, how could you get that from a snowball, a dirty snowball, so as they say, unless it was nuclear?
Well, you have to remember, first of all, that the flashes of light, things like that are usually produced by the gases that it's going into and not the actual snowball itself, if you will. Because you're taking this stuff and hitting it at 33 or 40,000 miles an hour, and a huge amount of energy is being released just by the slowdown of that. Effectively, that's what happened to the meteor that hit Russia.
Mm.
It was not the meteor itself that blew up. It was the gases around it that exploded as a result of the meteor going through.
Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. The phone number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. The Science Forum, Dr. Helen Giardella, is a professor of biological sciences at, can we still say SUNY Albany? Or do we
I
have
think
to...
so.
All right, I'll say SUNY Albany. Ed Stander, professor of geology and astronomy at the State University of New York at Cobleskill. Back to the phones we go. Carl in Palatine. Carl, you're on.
Hello there. Good to hear this great program from Count von Ray again.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, we missed it too.
How are you?
Wonderful people. The bottom line to my question, and it took me too long to explain to the caller, I realize is really the word inferential, and that being as a response to the explanations given earlier with regard to dark matter and the use of gravity and so forth. Word not for inference. And this applies to theology as well as geology and biology.
Hey, just a minute, Carl. Can you turn your radio or computer down?
I beg your pardon. I'll do it immediately.
Thanks. I appreciate that because there's a little delay.
I know that. I goofed.
Okay. Now, go ahead. Now, you were on to something, and Ed was nodding his head, so continue.
Inference. The easy one, how did we get to biological thingamajiggy that lives coming from essentially chemical processes at the beginning of Earth.
Oh, okay.
Okay,
yeah, I mean, if I knew that, I would get the Nobel Prize, and many people have, actually. But
well, this
one
is
thing...
your chance.
Oh.
Well, all right.
Let me think about this. One thing that I can say is that a lot of these molecules form spontaneously. For example, amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, seems to show up where we're getting amino acid signatures from some of the other, from space. And so apparently, if you have the right combination of molecules and conditions, you will get some of the precursors for living matter that will, we say, self-assemble or spontaneously assemble. The question about being alive means that whatever this is starting to control its own information. In other words, it's starting to develop something like a genetic code, although it may not be the kind of genetics that we think about. And it's being beginning to be able to reproduce itself so that we're starting to get something that can basically make more of itself. And once, I would say that once we start into that kind of a situation, we're on the way. One of the other issues has to do with the ability to use energy of various forms. And in the early days, it was probably chemical energy from hot vents and things like that. Eventually, photosynthesis,
excuse
of course.
Excuse me, would that include sulfur in the deep sea?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of these, archaean bacteria, archaean protozoa, not protists, there we go, archaean organisms that do not have a nucleus, but they do have genetic material, are using, and have been, as far as we know, energy from hydrogen vents and so forth, to run their metabolic machinery. And in fact, one of those is probably the ancestor of one of our types of cells, although several other things had to happen.
Very interesting. Carl, thanks a lot for the call. Oh. So we still don't know what that spark is. In other words, the building blocks can be there. And one of the things I learned when I was reading about this Russian meteor is that some of the meteors actually have sugars in them. One that crashed in Russia, which was one of the more basic ones that you were talking about, Ed. Mm-hmm. But some of them have sugars and different, organic, I guess, materials.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we don't know what that spark is.
I think we humans tend to think in terms of turning something on. You suddenly
be turned on, though, right?
Well, it could have happened several times. In other words, you had similar chemical concordances so that you had a situation where there were several possibilities for being able to utilize energy to make more of whatever it is, instead of having it just accidentally and spontaneously form. Now, once that happens, you have the blueprints for something we would call an organism. But again, it has to have control of information.
Right.
Because otherwise it's going to be all over the place. It has to be able somehow to reproduce itself, to be able to lay down a system by which it can make more of whatever it is. And that's awfully hard. It may have happened several different times.
But the building blocks...
The building blocks are there.
You know what they are. Okay, you know what they were. And it would seem to me that if all it took was just the right combination of things... We know enough about the way things were 3 billion years ago or whenever life began that we should be able to just keep trying and make it happen. And I know scientists are doing this.
Yeah, that's exactly what people are doing.
Why no success?
It's a certain amount of time required, I would think, first of all, and a certain environment, which hasn't been that well defined yet.
Okay. So we're not on, no one here says, well, maybe God has to have a hand.
I'm working in a basement. I haven't finished yet.
Okay, back to the phones we go. It's David in Cambridge. David.
I just caught that last line. That's funny. Anyways, hi there. Hi, Ray. Hi, panelists.
Hello.
I'm going to stray a little bit as to what I told Colleen on the phone because things have come up. But first, a quick shout out to my mom who's listening nearby in the other apartment. She used to be a panelist on what was a precursor of this show back in the early 60s.
Wow.
Albany Medical College. So,
well,
hey, Mom.
Hello.
But you were talking about faults, and again, this is deviates from what I told Colleen. But the Palisades, as I recall, that's a fault line, isn't? And if it is, whose fault is that?
And
the stupid reason why I'm calling up is they were talking about the styrofoam issue. Curiously enough, my sister who's an environmental science major, has a friend who found out who made makes these things, and she packs it up and ships them back to them, I guess much to their chagrin. But it's we don't recycle it here in Cambridge, which is to my chagrin, but it's number six, styrene, styrofoam.
Yeah.
So it's styrene plastic. So that's my two cents, the addendum, if you will, to this. And I'm all done.
That's it?
That's it.
All right.
Not bad for a rambling Aspie, eh?
Not bad, not bad. All right. Well, thank you very much, David. All right, so...
I can just say there's enough faults around for everybody.
Indeed. And we'll take a break here and be back through no fault of our own with more Vox Pop.
Gentlemen,
Support for WAMC comes from Maria College, Albany, New York, offering RN baccalaureate completion program, associate degrees, and professional certificate programs, day, evening, weekend, and online classes, mariacollege.edu. Joyelle's Jewelers, Del Mar, New York, specializing in custom jewelry and repair, laser welding, designer jewelry, and gifts, joyellsjewelers.com. Cafe Capriccio, offering private catering for groups of 10 to 40 and escorted tours to Tuscany, located in Albany and Saratoga Springs, cafecapriccio.com for reservations. And New York State Tobacco-Free Community Partners, working to help parents prevent and reduce youth smoking with prevention programs to counter tobacco marketing and help save lives, New York State Tobacco-Free Community Partners at smokefreecapital.org.
Frightened. Helen is speaking Russian. So we're back at Vox Pop. It's 1-800-348-2551. Ed Stander is here. Helen Giardella, Ray Graff, and our producer, Patrick Dungis, just walked in.
Hi,
with
Ray.
The latest from the social media.
Yes, we have a couple questions here. Jeffrey on WAMC.org says, I have heard it said that because of the velocity of the planet at the equator, traveling just over 1,000 miles per hour, that a green band of sediment can be seen in the oceans along the equatorial line, having been stirred up by the movement of the planet. Is this true?
Hmm.
Wow.
That's not an answer.
A green band. Well, there's lots of green bands.
Mm.
Whether it's due to the fact that at the equatorial zone it's rotating a little bit faster, I would check on.
Okay. Here's one for Helen from James on WAMC.org, and it says that. Here's one for Helen. In recent news, I've heard about biological hard drives using genetic code and DNA to store information.
Mm.
Could you explain how this might be possible?
Okay, I don't know enough about computers, et cetera, to go into, although maybe Ed can help. But one aspect of the DNA molecule is that it is using a very, very relatively simple storage mechanism that is four different base pairs, which can be combined in different combinations to give essentially the equivalent of letters and words, if you want to think about it that way. And it's very, very small, extremely compact. And the chemists are getting very good at being able to control how this molecule, we say, polymerizes.
And to read it.
And to read it. And so as a result, and we can make it at room temperature and usually without nasty solvents, which is another aspect of all of this, biodegradable. And so if it can be configured in a stable form so that this array of base pairs is coding for what we want to express, as opposed to whether or not we should be adding a particular amino acid at this point in this protein, we can use it.
Wow.
Yeah.
And
it's been done. They've taken it, they've written messages in it, and then come back out. The big difference between DNA and a hard drive is that computers work on ones and zeros.
Right.
And therefore, you only have really a choice of on or off. But a DNA, you've got four pair.
So
you can combine them. Oh, you can find you. It's always two pair and two pair, but it gives you a much larger alphabet if you want to work with.
Theoretically faster, then, right?
It can be faster. Yeah, actually not so much as a hard drive, but they've been talking about encrypting messages with it.
Mm.
You want to send a message to somebody and you don't want them to know about it, you give them an extra cell.
Well, there's a James Bond device. All right, what else you got,
All right,
Patrick?
We got two more, but I'm going to compress them into one regarding the meteor over Russia. So this is for Richard on WAMC.org and Scott on Facebook. I saw a picture of a 20-plus-foot hole in the ice in a lake in Russia. The story was that part of the meteor crashed. crashed into the lake. Maybe that was the big piece. Drill tools don't turn on a dime and make a right angle turn. They make an arch over some right. number of feet, ending and going in the direction they want. It may take 300 feet to make the turn, was the comment. Okay. So I guess just generally right. talking about this 20-foot hole in the ice.
Yeah, problem is, as far as the drilling is concerned, is that, yes, they don't turn on a dime. You have to make an arc to do it. But the question is, how do you make it do the arc at a mile down? And that's a trick. That's mm-hmm. something I don't know okay. about. You may have mm-hmm. to actually spin it in a certain direction to
Patrick,
do that.
Patrick, thanks a lot. Appreciate it, pal. The 20-foot hole in the ice, by the way, initially, you know, all the Russian scientists and officials were there, and they were standing around, pictured standing around. But now they say that the hole was not from that. So I don't know what to believe.
Well, at 33,000 miles an hour, it could be buried an awful long way down in the mud okay. underneath that hole.
All right. I'll tell
but
you what.
But it doesn't have to be very big. The piece that makes the hole could be very small.
All right, let's go to Paul in Schenectady. Paul, you're on.
Hi. I have a very simple question. With these meteorites and asteroids and so forth, are they always coming from the same direction, or is it coming from different directions, and why would they come from one direction or different direction?
Well, if they're just sitting in space and we come on them, then they'll come from the same direction. Does that make sense? In other words, if they're just sitting there, we hit them. So it's not actually the meteorite that's moving or the meteor that's moving. It's we that's moving into the path of the meteor.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And that's the question. That's what happens during meteor storms. When we go through a cloud of dust that's effectively sitting there and they all come at us from the same direction, it's because that's the direction we're moving. Hmm. On the other hand, if it's big enough, it can come from any direction it wants to, simply because it already has a speed of its own. And as long as it's moving faster than we are, it'll catch up with us and go in.
Wouldn't it have to be moving in some direction? In other words, doesn't everything that sits out in our solar system move in some direction?
No, there's clouds of dust out there that are sitting there forever and don't move at all.
Wow. So the sun has no, the gravity has no impact at all?
No, the sun has a relatively big impact on big things, but on little things like dust particles, very, very little.
I'll be darned. Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go over to Alan in Kingston. Alan, you're on.
Yes, I have a baby boomer biology question. Why does the hair of older mammals, older humans, but all mammals, turn gray or white when they get old? And why the color gray? Hmm. Why not some other color? And I'll hang up and let you answer.
Thanks a lot, Alan. We appreciate it. All right, Helen, okay. Answer that one for us.
Well, there is a pigment. There is a biological molecule that we call melanin, which is responsible for black, brown, tan, for a lot of the variations on brown that we see in mammals and other organisms. And normally, our hair has, well, the hair is made of protein, and it's got a hollow center, which has, among other things, melanin in it.
Mm-hmm.
But as we get older, we tend to make less melanin. And so the melanin is no longer being put into the hair. You might notice that older people also have much paler skin because everybody, even if you're from Iceland, has a little bit of melanin in the skin.
Mm.
That also tends to fade. And so we're just not making as much of that pigment. And so the hair sometimes gets a lusterish sheen because now it's got air where originally there was melanin pigment. Other colors, well, if you come from certain populations, you're going to have other pigments such as what we call carotenoids from carrots. Not necessarily exactly the same molecule, but the point is that this is what gives the Irish, for example, a fair preponderance of red hair.
Oh.
And I don't know whether that fades to the same extent, but you're not going to get other colors simply because either we've got the brown pigment or the dark brown pigment, or we don't.
Wow.
And so that's going to be the question.
Well, Alan, does that answer your question to some extent? He's gone. All right, fair enough. Well, that answered my question. I guess it's Grecian formula all around. Let's go over to Tom in Greenville. Tom, you're on.
Thank you. I have two questions. The first one is about fracking.
Yep.
I'd like to know if the panel thinks it's safe or unsafe.
Okay. Well, it's standard question for this program. What do you think?
My answer is that it is safe provided it's done properly. Mainly, the main reason I say that is because the fracking rocks, the rocks that we frack, are usually a mile or so down, and the chances of the fracking fluids at that depth getting into the water column are extremely remote. However, if the well is not properly cased, if there are holes in the casing as it goes up towards the surface, then the fracking fluids can get out and do grave damage. And mainly, the basic problem that's happened in the past is if it's not done correctly, if it's done cheaply, then there's a major problem. So that's the long and short of it as far as I'm concerned.
All right, Tom, what's your second?
I'm sorry. As I understand it, what you're saying is it's more an issue, a social issue or an issue of oversight, et cetera, rather than an actual physical drilling issue.
Well, it's an actual physical drilling issue that it has to be done correctly.
Right.
And if it's not done correctly, then there's major problems. On the social side of it, we have decided that global warming is a greater damage to our society and to our environment. And if we don't use the natural gas that comes out of the ground that way, then we're going to have to go back to coal within 10 or 15 years because we're almost out.
I'm going to start an argument right here.
Oh, boy, here we go. Thanks, Helen.
Not really. There's an unexamined assumption, and that is that we can continue to use energy at the same level. And let's not go there right now. But
good.
If this is not factored into the discussion, we're
agreed.
Going to continue to make the same mistakes,
well, just
whatever they are.
If I can give you a very simple example, if we were to outlaw incandescent lamps today and replace them all with compact fluorescents, we probably wouldn't have to do any hydrofracking. If we were to change our refrigerators and take everybody that has a refrigerator in their garage full of beer and get rid of those and put in brand new refrigerators, we wouldn't need to do hydrofracking because we'd have enough electricity to go around.
In other words, these are complex
those
questions.
Those are social problems.
Yeah, that's my point.
Well, you see what you've done, Tom? This is what you're famous for.
Well,
you stir it up. Now, what's your second question?
Thank you. My second question is, did anybody do their homework from last week and look into chemtrails?
Oh, no, that was a different panel. So the next time we do the show will be that panel. And I'll tell you what, most everybody who's on the show, if they get homework, they do their homework. And I believe that gentleman was from RPI, I want to say. And so, that'll be the next show. But, Tom, thanks a lot. Let's go to Roz and Dalton. Roz.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey.
Hey, I was just wondering, why does Russia get all the impacts and everything? You know, I was just curious.
Oh, because the magnetic north is in Russia.
And that's it? It just attracts everything?
I think Russia's just very lucky. They're,
oh, really?
They hit all over the world all the time.
And mostly over water. Then we don't see the big
ones,
right?
Mostly over water. I mean, one of the most famous meteorites ever to hit was in Peekskill, just down south of us, because it went into a guy's trunk of a guy's car.
Oh, yes.
And there's a fellow in Schenectady who actually bought that car and has it in the museum. So,
oh, boy.
You know, they occur all the time. It's just that sometimes the big ones are more obvious if you have a lot of land and
yeah, that
a few
was
people.
My point going to be. Russia is fairly
big.
Large, and so the chances are a lot greater that within her borders.
Oh, well, okay, thank you.
Hey, Roz, count your blessings. Thanks. 1-800-348-2551. Jody in Lake Hill is on. Jody.
Thank you. I have a question and a comment. I guess I'll give my comment first because the show has seemed to take a turn. But weighing in on the hydrofracking, I really appreciate all the calls and information that's coming out about it and that you guys talk about and that many of your listeners know about. And I think there has not been a technology that I know of in my lifetime, and I can use some melatonin or whatever that was myself. I've been around a while. And I've never seen a technology that wasn't misused in some way. It's just that's the scary part in a way, other than the physical aspect are the, I guess, the weak parts of human beings.
Right. If I can make a quick statement on that, it's very simple that if you there's a choice in this world, and the choice is either to do it or not to do it. If you want to have free will and democracy of such that everyone can do whatever they want to in this world, then these sort of things have to happen. If you're willing to control certain things so that, for example, get rid of incandescent lights or anything like that, then it can be avoided. But therein lies the problem, really. It's
but
a social
again,
issue.
I'm going to say it is so complex when you consider how much we have invested in, for example, fluorescent lights.
Yep.
And on a slightly sarcastic note, we have sometimes kidded that the true ecologist is the guy who got his house in the mountains last year. In other words, everybody has something invested one way or the other or another way or a fourth way. And that's what makes it so difficult.
Mm, well put. Jody, what's your question?
Well, I just want to say the last investment or the biggest investment is our health and the health of everyone and the planet. And I think it's if there should be a mistake, it should be erring on the side of protecting our environment.
Okay.
That's all. That's all I have to say about that. But my question is, my husband has what he thinks is a meteorite.
Ooh.
And he took it up to RPI, and I forget the fellow's name who looked at it, who said he could not really tell conclusively. And he suggested that he take it, I believe, to the Museum of Natural History and see someone who was a so-called expert. Can you give me any bead on who he might show that to?
Hmm. There is a fellow in Schenectady who has one of the largest meteorite collections in the world. And I believe it's meteoriteman.com or something of that nature. But if you look up meteorite and Schenectady, you'll probably find him and you can check. The biggest problem with testing meteorites is, generally speaking, you have to open them up. And you may not want to. For example, if it's an iron meteorite, then you'll etch it with nitric acid or iron chloride or something like that. Or you can see the little balls inside that make it a chondrite. So that's how you usually do it.
Okay. Does it take a big amount to do that?
Not necessarily.
Okay. All right. Okay, well, thank you then.
Yeah, call us back next time and let us know if it really was.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye.
1-800-348-2551. Bera in Highland, you're on.
Hi. I had two questions. Okay. The first question is, approximately how much crude oil is being extracted from the earth on a daily basis?
All right.
And the second question is, what is filling that void?
Okay, well, we have 2 minutes.
Well, in the United States, we are extracting and refining approximately 20 million gallons per year. Per year? Per day?
Per day.
Per day. And what's filling the void? Generally speaking, it's removed by putting detergents down into the rock, and the detergents break up the surface tension around the sand grains to bring it up. So it's either air or it's simple detergent that goes down there to close it up.
Hmm.
So if it's detergent, it is completely filling the void.
Not necessarily. Down in Houston, Texas, for example, they've extracted so much oil that the city is now about 40 feet lower than it used to be.
Wow.
And that's because the ground has collapsed because they've been taking the material out. So not everything is taken out for sure.
All right. So, and this is happening around the world.
Correct.
That's just my concern, because this is Houston's just one small area, but on the other side of the globe, the same thing is happening, and I'm just curious when the world will implode.
Well, it's only they're only taking it from the from the top part of the Earth. The vast majority of the Earth is the mantle, and there's no oil down there.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at a little skim on the top of the mantle that's on the maximum 30 miles thick. So it's not going to have much effect on the Earth per se.
Wow.
Is all the oil? I'm sorry.
It'll just sink.
Yeah, locally.
Okay.
Is all the oil from biogenic, essentially, from organisms that...
There's been a suggestion that some oil is made by other ways.
Okay.
The Swedes convinced the Russians a couple of years ago to dig down in granite to find oil.
Okay.
They went down like a mile, and they didn't find anything.
Okay.
So. All right. Well, I guess that's the way we will leave it. That was a fun program, and thank you to our scientists, Dr. Helen Giardella and Dr. Ed Stander. And we thank everybody for calling in today. Sorry if you didn't make it through. You can always comment online at our website, wamc.org/voxpop. That's one way to do it, and the comments will be there. You can also go to our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/WAMC radio. Support for WAMC comes from Barry Price Architecture since 1996, specializing in residential and institutional buildings that integrate modernism and sustainability with regional materials and aesthetics. BarryPriceArchitecture.com. Carrie Haddad Gallery, Hudson, New York, presenting abstract paintings by Adam Cohen and Mexican photographic portraits by Russell Monk, now through March 3rd, CarrieHaddadGallery.com. Curran Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York, providing legal and consulting services to life insurers in a changing regulatory climate, CurrentCompliance.com, and Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York. Women-owned and operated with a combined 70 years' experience. Eye exams by appointment, 518-459-2638. Helen and Ed, thanks for being here. Come back again. All right. Thanks again for joining us. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who is our engineer. Colleen O'Connell answered your calls. Patrick Donges, who you heard a little while ago, is our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we will hear your Oscar predictions, and we will discuss the nominees with Rob Edelman and Audrey Kupferberg. It's an Oscar show. We do it every year. Always good fun. Stay tuned now for a news update.